From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Barbara Kingsolver, whose new book is Unsheltered, published by Harper. Barbara Kingsolver is the author of 9 best-selling works of fiction, including the novels Flight Behavior, The Lacuna, The Poisonwood Bible, Animal Dreams, and The Bean Trees, as well as books of poetry, essays, and creative nonfiction. Her work of narrative nonfiction is the enormously influential bestseller Animal, Vegetable, Miracle, A Year of Food Life. Barbara Kingsolver's work has been translated into more than 20 languages and has earned literary awards and a devoted readership at home and abroad. She was awarded the National Humanities Medal, our country's highest honor for service through the arts, as well as the prestigious Dayton Literary Peace Prize for her body of work. She lives with her family on a farm in southern Appalachia. Unsheltered is a timely novel that interweaves past and present to explore the human capacity for resiliency and compassion in times of great upheaval. How could 2 hardworking people do everything right in life, a woman asks, and end up destitute? Willa Knox and her husband followed all the rules as responsible parents and professionals and have nothing to show for it but debts and an inherited brick house that is falling apart. The magazine where Willa worked has folded. The college where her husband had tenure has closed. Their dubious shelter is also the only option for a disabled father-in-law and an exasperating, free-spirited daughter. When the family's one success story, an Ivy-educated son, is uprooted by tragedy, he seems likely to join them with dark complications of his own. In another time, a troubled husband and public servant asks, "How can a man tell the truth and be reviled for it?" A science teacher with a passion for honest investigation, Thatcher Greenwood finds himself under siege. His employer forbids him to speak of the exciting work just published by Charles Darwin. His young bride and social climbing mother-in-law bristle at the risk of scandal and dismiss his worries that their elegant house is unsound. In a village ostensibly founded as a benevolent utopia, Thatcher wants only to honor his duties, but his friendships with a woman scientist and a renegade newspaper editor threaten to draw him into a vendetta with the town's powerful men. Unsheltered is the story of 2 families in 2 centuries who live at the corner of 6th and Plum in Vineland, New Jersey, navigating what seems to be the end of the world as they know it. With history as their tantalizing canvas, these characters paint a startlingly relevant portrait of life in precarious times, when the foundations of the past have failed to prepare us for the future. When I spoke with Barbara Kingsolver, I began by asking how she came to link these 2 stories to place, the corner of 6th and Plum in Vineland, New Jersey. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, I decided to put them together before I knew where they would be or even who they would be.
Oh.
I always begin with theme, and it's so interesting to me that every writer has a different process. And I know many writers who begin with a character or they begin with incident, and they just, you know, kind of see this person have a person in mind and they just follow them into the woods. Well, if I did that, you would not want to go with me and we'd never get out again. That's not the way I work. It works beautifully for some writers, but what works for me is to decide first what I want to write about.
Okay.
What it is that's worrying me, that's keeping me up at night. That's what gets me to my computer in the morning, because I feel like it's a big ask for me to say to you, okay, put your life down for 10 hours or however long it's going to take.
Right.
That's a huge thing to ask. And so I want to make sure before I do that, that I have something to talk about with you, because I think literary fiction is a conversation. It's not a telling, it's more of an asking. This conversation I have with my reader, I want it to be about something really important that's probably worrying them too, that's keeping you up at night too.
Mm-hmm.
So I began with this question about the end of the world as we know it. It seemed to me that we were coming into an unprecedented time when we keep trying to fix our new problems with old solutions. I wanted to write about that, why it is that people cling to familiar shelter even when it's collapsing around their ears. It's really difficult to understand a crisis when you're in the middle of it. So I thought it would be useful to look back at some earlier time when people were similarly facing kind of the end of their world, the end of a paradigm, when they felt that their familiar security was collapsing.
Right.
So really early in the game of this particular novel, I devised this this convention, or this I plotted out this device that I would have two sets of characters living in two different centuries in the same place in a house that was falling down, both then and now. So I had the structure of my story, and I knew the time. I early on settled on around 1875, right after the Civil War, when the U.S. was absolutely as polarized as it is now, when it looked as impossible as it does now to put these two nations back together into one. There was just no way of doing that anyone could see. And then into this walks Darwin and his colleagues, who were saying, oh, and by the way, everything you ever believed about your place in the universe might be wrong. And people were completely disoriented, angry at each other, perceiving scarcity, holding on to the old ways for all they were worth. You know, kind of the more out of control things felt, the louder people hollered about bringing back the old order, making humanity great again.
Right.
That's what they would have put on their ball caps in those days. So these were the two stories which I decided to make one story, and so I invented my sets of characters. I had my contemporary characters pretty well in mind. All of the problems they have are pretty familiar ones.
Yeah.
Most of us know, hopefully no one family with all of those problems, but right. Many families with at least one of them.
Right.
And so that was not too much of a stretch of the imagination, but I needed to find characters for my 19th century story who were somehow intimately involved with the Darwinian debate.
Right.
I needed somebody with a dog in that fight. At first I thought it would be Darwin, and then I decided, no, I needed to set this story in the United States. So I was reading a lot about Asa Gray and various other men of science of that time, and then I happened upon a woman of science, Mary Treat, a name I'd never heard before.
A great name.
And she's real, and what a treat she turned out to be. When I went looking for her, I realized, first of all, she's completely unknown. Very few people know anything about her. She's never been, studied. No biography has been written of her. But she left all of her papers in the historical society in the town where she lived, which was Vineland, New Jersey. So I went there hoping to find something, and what I found was a gold mine, not just this woman who had a really interesting life and a crazy husband, but also this town that was very self-consciously founded as a utopian ideal in the terms of that a Victorian mind could conceive of utopia,
right,
which was very class structured. You know, some people did all the work and some people kind of got to benefit from the spoils of the agricultural labor without getting their hands dirty. And so I thought, this is perfect, because here is a perfect sort of emblematic place with all of the elements of hope coming apart, hope crumbling. And to set my story in this place then and now was even better than I had imagined.
Yeah.
And that and Vineland, the Vineland of the 19th century, even had its bullhorn, its bullying leadership, who everyone sort of looked to for answers when they got scared. So I looped around actually for several years before finding the place to set this novel. But when I found Mary Treat, she was a lightning rod. She just drew all of the electricity of my imagination into the ground of that place.
Now, when it takes several years to find what you want, is that very frustrating? Do you feel like you need to just kind of like, I mean, I think that I could imagine jumping ahead before it was time.
It's not frustrating because I've done this for long enough to know good things take time.
Mm-hmm.
This is my 15th book. Now, it would be frustrating if I had nothing else to do during those years and if I didn't have any income. that would be actually not possible. But there's a rhythm to the way I work. I always have a project on the front burner that's exciting and keeps me, you know, creatively engaged and at my desk every day. And then there are several more on the back burner, and I never quite know which one is going to boil over first, but I know there's something next in the pipeline, to mix metaphors. We've just gone from a stove to a pipeline. but it's kind of, it gives me a lot of psychic security to have these other projects on the back of my mind that are just, you know, they're just kind of ripening. And I can do this sort of casual research trying to, you know, I remember, years before I actually started this book, I was talking with friends and, you know, with my husband about wanting to write about paradigm shift and kind of working out how the story would be structured. But while I was doing this casual research, like going to Darwin's house, for example, just kind of investigating how it would be to use Darwin as a character,
right,
that's not the main thing I was working on just then. I was on the book tour for Flight Behavior, I think, in the UK when I did that. But I had other projects I was working on. So it's really important to write no novel before its time.
Mm-hmm.
Once I get to that point where all the elements are in place, most of the research is done, and I click over into sitting down and writing scenes, you know, having the voice and just channeling that voice onto the page and writing scenes, writing paragraphs, writing sentences, writing dialogue every day, then it becomes a different process. Then that's front burner. That's, you know, that's the sauce that you have to continually stir or it will scald. you know, and then there's something else at the back. And I already know. I mean, I knew as this book went into production, I had three other ideas. And
okay.
It's really important to know which book is next because for a writer, the only one that matters is the one that's coming next. It is perhaps an ungracious thing to say on a book tour or in an interview about the book that I finished, you know, this 10 months ago, that in some ways it's like dead. It's like fingernails, you know, that you're ready to clip off.
Right.
I'm really happy. Now, it's much better than that. I don't want to devalue it. Its value is complete. Its value, as far as I'm concerned, is it's the best book. That is exactly the book I wanted to make. It's insofar as I'm able to do so, it's perfect. I'm happy to let it go out into the world. But talking about it, you know, for months and months and months, that's a bit frustrating.
Yeah.
Because where I would love to be is working on the next book.
Is in the next one.
But,
yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, we make concessions to actual life and the royalty checks. And so and it's not just, of course, about making a living. It's about the purpose of all this is not just it's not just an exercise of me alone in a room. I want to give it to the world. I want this conversation now to happen in households you know, and in bedrooms, you know, with all over the country and all over the world, where people put their life away for a few hours and pick up this book off the nightstand.
Even when you finish the book, the theme still exists, right?
Yeah,
that started
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yes, I mean, it is exciting to have to launch the book out in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you about voice. Do you mind if I read a couple of little things from the book?
Of course. No, you can't. Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So both of your storylines are in a sort of third person close. So we're sort of with the characters' mm-hmm. points of view, even though it's not in the first person. So here's one from Willa.
Okay.
One of the neighbor kids slid out his back door. His glance hit Willa and bounced off quickly as he cut through the maze of cars in his yard and headed out to the alley. He and his brother worked on the vehicles, mostly at night, sliding tools back and forth under portable utility lights. Their quiet banter and intermittent Spanish expletives of frustration or success drifted through Willa's bedroom windows as the night music of a new town. So that's lovely. And that's Willa. And then here's one from Thatcher. Thatcher had heard from more reliable sources than Rose that this woman, he's talking about the next-door neighbor, Mary Treat, held strange entertainments. He tilted his head for a clearer look through one of the little panes, wondering what architect had dreamed up these hateful windows, multiple interlaced lenses of leaded glass, as intricate as the hide of a fish. The house had 1,000 of these panes rattling loose in their nettings. So as I read this book, I was so taken with how you got their voices down, and their voices are so different, both from the perspective of being different characters, but also from different distinct time periods. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, they're living 150 years apart.
Right.
That was the largest craft challenge of the book, to interlace these two stories in voices that are authentic, that are authentic to their different times.
Yes.
So, I mean, there are all sorts of things about that that are difficult. One of them is really knowing that era well enough to speak in its language, which was different. I mean, just for example, people in 1875 didn't generally use contractions. Sometimes they did, but most often they would say "it is," "I am," instead of "it's" and "I'm."
Yeah.
And so the language was different. Not to mention the clothes they wore and the food they ate and everything else. And you know, you have to present this world through the eyes of people who don't know what they're missing. So, you know, you can't say it was dark because they didn't have electricity. They didn't know about electricity. You know, it's the fish doesn't know what
water
is.
Yeah.
So as a writer, I had to know this world and become this world so intimately that I wasn't translating, you know, from another language. I was thinking in that language. And then, okay, but we haven't even gotten to the hard part. And then I wanted to tell that story in its authentic 19th century voice in a way that was exactly as compelling, at least as compelling to the reader, as the contemporary story, because I had decided to tell the story in alternating chapters.
Right.
So you read a chapter from Willa's point of view, then chapter two, you're in Thatcher's point of view. For a few seconds, at least, you might be treading water. The very first, you know, when you begin chapter two, you think, what, where am I? And then it might take, you know, depending on the reader, anywhere from 1 to 35 sentences to figure out, hopefully not 35, but to figure out, oh, I'm in another, this is the same place, but a different narrator and a different time. And then, you know, pretty soon you figure out there's been a carriage accident outside and the horses ran into the tobacco shop, and that kind of, you know, you get the picture.
Right.
So, but there's always the risk that, I mean, not not everybody reads as many 19th century novels as I do. Not everybody, I'm aware, loves Dickens, you know, or Thomas Hardy, and, you know, and would choose those as a preferred entertainment. Many people, because they're less familiar, might find that language stuffy, might find those characters stuffy because they're, you know, because, you know, here's a couple who didn't have sex before marriage. This man is just, he's just in completely enthralled to the physical charms of his wife because they're newlyweds and he's new to sex, which is, you know, would be really weird in modern times.
Right.
So all sorts of things about these characters could feel, oh, just, well, I mean, to put it simply, old-fashioned or kind of less compelling. So it's my challenge as a writer to make Thatcher's story a place you want to be. Every time you leave the year 2017 or whatever year it is, it's about that, and go to 1875, I want you to say, yes, yeah. Good, back here. Yeah. And then when you bump forward again into the modern story, I want you to be happy. You're back there. Whichever place you're in, I want you to be there and to be excited and not feel disappointed that you just had to leave the other story. So there are many, you know, many, many different ways to make that happen. But one of them is to construct a plot really carefully and really braid together these characters' concerns and conflicts so that it really feels like one story. So when you're moving forward in one chapter, you're also moving forward in the other.
Yeah.
So if you see what I mean, it's sort of like it's the story takes place really in one year, sort of from late summer into the early summer of the following year. And so that's, among other things, I was really careful about timing so that you're moving forward, you know, it's September, it's October, it's November, and you're, you know, and it's approaching Christmas, and, you know, all of the same things, the same weather, the same sort of cultural calendar is happening in both places.
Yeah.
And there, you know, and there are a million other tricks, ways that you do this. But what I wanted is for it to feel like one story.
Yeah. And I thought another wonderful way that you linked the stories and also led us from transition to transition was incorporating the final words of each chapter into the next chapter as a chapter title. That was really interesting.
Exactly.
I loved that. When did that come to you and how did you come up with doing that?
It was early in the first draft.
It was.
And it was my husband's idea.
Ah.
And he reminded me that a long, long time ago, the first book I wrote was actually not The Bean Trees, my first published novel. I wrote a book before that, which was published a little after my first novel, called Holding the Line, a nonfiction book about women in this mine strike.
Right.
In this mine strike.
Okay.
There was a violent conflict that happened in Arizona. It was before I was a novelist. I was a lot of other things, but one of them was a journalist, and I was a stringer, and I was sent out to these picket lines to get this story, and then I ended up writing a book. And I did about, I don't know, hundreds of hours of interviews, and then it ended up being mostly an oral history. I put these interviews with these women together into a book, and I did that very thing, that each chapter would end with a quote, and then I would use that for the title of the next chapter.
Okay.
It's just, you know, something I did. And Stephen, my husband, we were in the kitchen. I mean, the moment was sort of riveted in my memory. He said, I was telling him, I have to link these stories together really carefully and make people feel like they're moving forward. And he said, well, why don't you do that thing you did in Holding the Line? And I said, whoa, I had totally forgotten about that. This was in my arsenal. And it was actually it's not the solution, but it was one very good tool to apply to this problem. And it really helps. It helps to focus. You know, chapter titles for me are like topic sentences. They're telling you, okay, look for this. This is what this chapter is going to be about. And so it was really a lovely way to bring what someone said into the meaning of the next chapter.
Yeah.
And you can only do that, of course, if you, you know, if you do, if you revise 100 times, you know, you write the story first and then you go back and rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it until everything is connected.
Yeah.
By knowing exactly where I'm going, I can make all the details click together.
Yeah.
So that they're all, everything is headed the right way. And so there's no magic trick, of course. It just looks like magic, ideally. But really, it's just lots and lots of work.
Yeah, but you know, as a reader, I think one thing that that did was it made me very anxious to see how you were going to incorporate those words into the next chapter. You know, mm-hmm. what would that link be? What? How is she going to end this and link it to the next one? And I think that when you change voice from chapter to chapter, sometimes it can be a little disorienting. But in this case, I was always happy to get to the next chapter. And I also found that particular thing that you were doing, structural thing, really interesting just as a reader. So,
yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, it's connecting language with meaning.
Yeah.
And so it helps to bridge that gap between two different languages when it's just sort of a slightly self-conscious way of saying, regardless of language, this means the same. But another thing that I did for the same end was make the exact same things happen sometimes in one chapter. And in the two different times, you know, maybe several chapters later, something that had happened or something that one character thought or said would pop up in the other century.
Yes.
So that it's just another way of saying people are people.
Yes.
We tend to look back in history and imagine that people who lived 150 years ago were somehow less sophisticated than we are, that they were somehow less, not quite as human as we are. But that isn't true.
Well, it's funny, all the pictures are in black and white. And I think that that somehow makes it seem so distant. And I recently saw a picture online. Somebody had done this incredible job of colorizing a picture of Chekhov. It is so, it just brings him right into... It was really amazing. I don't know. It's not like the colorized mm-hmm. movies mm-hmm. that were so bright and poppy. It just looked so real. And I thought, oh, wow, that is amazing. Anyway.
He was a guy.
He was real. Look at that.
Yeah, he was real. Yeah, it's true. It's interesting. Before photography, you know, somehow photography makes people real to us. And even black and white photographs don't make them quite real to us because it's not the way our vision sees, unless we're, you know, one of those rare, unfortunate people without color vision, but yes, it's true. But that's maybe that's why I love 19th century novels because you know, I mean, Middlemarch, I could just finish it and pick it up tomorrow and read it again and again. It's everything, and maybe part of why I love it is that the movie I see in my head is in living color. You know, I
yes.
can see Dorothea. And Casaubon, and you know, I can see them all vividly in my head, and I don't think of them as pictures. I think of them as people, and I hear them as people, and so that's what I wanted to do with this story by telling it in two centuries. You know, it just I wanted to kind of ask some questions about how we're behaving. How we imagine that we know exactly what's ahead of us, and you know that we can use the same old solutions to fix the problems that are coming, you know, coming up next, and how normal it is really for people to change radically. If you just look at how people lived 150 years ago. Yes, they applied very different solutions to their problems, and they were just as human as we are. So if we change radically, we will still be human. We will still be ourselves. We'll just behave differently.
Right, right. Okay, I want to ask you a question about Willa.
Okay.
Willa is in middle age, and Earlier, when I was reading from the book to you, I read about how the neighbor kid's glance hit Willa and bounced off quickly. And then there's this other part where her husband refers to her menopause. There's a lot about how she's missing her mother who passed away just recently before the storyline begins. And then you also frequently write about the things that she almost says or does, but then changes her mind about. One example is she decides not to mention the cost of gas or her son's job search, you know, after he spends the day driving his baby around. She has her own reasons for this, but I also detected a kind of subtle self-censorship and self-questioning that I thought seemed to go along with middle age for her. I don't know.
And specifically being a woman of a certain age.
Right.
Yeah. Having reached that age where it's this sort of double bind, she's invisible, she's redundant.
Yes.
I mean, you know, in the literal and figurative sense, the work, she was really good at her job, and then her job disappeared because the magazine where she was an editor folded.
Right.
She has done everything right in life, followed all the rules, and reached this point where she's got nothing. There was no Easter egg at the end of this hunt.
Right.
And so she feels like a failure, like the invisible person. And at the same time, she's holding her whole, it's on her to hold this whole family together, four generations of people. And she's the caretaker. She's the one who's got to get Nick, her father-in-law, her grumpy, difficult father-in-law, to the doctor, to see the doctor he doesn't want to see. She's got to deal with these kids, who are both in their 20s with every kind of problem, sort of opposite problems, but still really, you know, difficult. She says this thing, which, I mean, no character I've ever written is me. But you will find things I believe to be true coming out of their mouths sometimes. And one of the things Willa says that I believe is that a mother can only be as happy as her unhappiest child.
Yeah.
So that's where she is. And it kind of extends to the whole family. She is only as happy as the unhappiest person in her little solar system there. And they're all pretty miserable. So she's the glue. She's the caretaker of this family, and she also feels invisible. She sits at the dinner table just watching them all argue, you know, with their you know, making all their different mission statements. And she's just kind of thinking, I wish they would just shut up and eat this wonderful dinner.
It's an
I made.
Incredibly intelligent argument, though.
As they can be, but you can still wish that everybody would just shut up and eat. Or at another point, she wonders how many tuition dollars have gone into this conversation, and if she could get some of it back. I mean, I think, you know, there are some readers will, you know, who don't know what it's like to be Willa will just think, wow, she's not very confident, is she? And others will read her and say, wow, Barbara nailed that. So, you know, but that's okay. I mean, there are many different kinds of characters in this novel.
Yeah.
And all of them are true. I mean, I love them all. They all have something to add.
Although that must be painful to put them in such terrible positions.
Yeah, but you know, that's what we novelists do. We throw our characters in hot water and we watch them boil.
All right. So,
but I will also say, in defense of this novel, it's also about a happy marriage, which I set out to do. I mean, I recognize that everybody in this novel has has all kinds of troubles, but Willa and Jano have just the best marriage.
Yeah.
They really, really, it's not just that they love each other, they make each other's lives work.
And he makes her laugh, which is hard.
Yeah, right. They function beautifully as a unit. And I wanted to do that for two reasons. One is, you know, I couldn't make you this miserable and not give you something really happy to take out of it. But also because when did you ever read about a happy marriage?
Right.
People never do this.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I think there's really something worthy of study here. What makes a good marriage tick? It's obviously not one thing, it's many things, but why not write about that? I don't really think it's true that, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, we're all writers are thinking, you know, we're living by the rule of every happy family is alike. It's the unhappy ones that are of interest. But that isn't true. Every happy family isn't the same. And every happy marriage isn't boring. So that's something that I wanted to do.
Yeah, that was a kind gift that you gave to Willa.
Well, you're welcome.
So at one point, Willa is distracting herself by watching out a window. And then eventually you write her shame sends her back to her computer. And you write, she sat listlessly, changing a word here, there, hitting undo, then redo, stuck in dawdle mode. So I loved that. And I wanted to know what you do when this happens
not
to
that,
you.
Not that I've ever been there.
Right. My characters aren't me, but...
Well, certainly every writer knows that mode.
Right.
And what I do, well, if it's, you know, if it's near the beginning of a novel, then I know, I probably need to get up and, you know, just like run around the block or something and come back. But it's, I also recognize, I mean, usually when that happens, it means I'm actually finished. I should turn the darn thing in.
Oh, well, that's good. Okay, so that's a revision moment for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, I love revision. That's my favorite part of a process. Mm. So I rarely get stuck in dawdle mode. I love just digging in and saying to myself, how can I make this better today? How can I make this sentence really just ring like a bell? You know, how can I get this paragraph to work? That's my favorite thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of ringing like a bell, I wanted to read one of the sentences that just, I loved this. It was so beautiful. Thatcher is in Mary Treat's home, I think maybe for the first time. And he's noticing, mm-hmm. he's noticing the surroundings in her home. And she has these jars that are like tiny little terrariums. And we found out later that they have spiders in them. But anyway, you write, each jar was half filled with soil and planted with a miniature garden of mosses, wildflowers, and ferns. The breath of these small green worlds moistened the inner curve of the jar's glass shoulders. I just loved that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't know if I have a question, except maybe if you could talk about, I don't know, watching your work for opportunities to add detail. And I don't know, does the detail come in the first draft for you usually, that sort of moment?
No, it's interesting that I'm always, you know, when someone says, I want to read this sentence, I just, my heart is sort of, you know, in my throat, I think, which sentence will she pick? And, you know, because I never know. And then when you read that, I remember exactly my process. It was on the third or fourth draft that I thought, I want the reader to see those glass jars, so I just paused and closed my eyes and pictured it, and I saw the little droplets of water, how they collect, you know, on the upper side of the glass, mm-hmm. of a round. If you've, you know, it helps that I've seen round glass jars, you know, with lids that are, so I know, you know, the moisture just kind of evaporates and collects, and so I just looked at that picture in my mind and then thought about breath and condensation and how to get that image economically into that sentence. You know, I mean, I spent, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes on that sentence, just making it, I mean, it was already written, but making it a poem,
yeah.
I guess you could say, and then you move on to the next sentence.
Yeah.
And every single one is worthy of that kind of respect, of that kind of honor. You know, every sentence needs to be honored. I look at it, I ask myself, what does it need to do, and how could it be more perfect? And, you know, it's not always about adding detail. Sometimes, I mean, I can always add more. I love visual images. I tend to kind of work from a movie in my head. I see... I visualize the scene very clearly first to get myself into it so that I know where everything is. And the temptation then is to, I know where all the doors are and all the windows and exactly what's on the table and the tablecloth and, what everybody's wearing. But you don't need to know all that. I mean, the book would be, 10 million pages long. So sometimes, so it's a question of getting the right detail in.
Exactly.
The few perfect brushstrokes that will give you enough to go on so that then you, the reader, can fill in all the rest of it, with your own details. So sometimes I overwrite an early draft and then revision involves pruning. And it's not always kind of all the way through, but there may be some scenes where I have put in too much detail and it's going to slow down the story. So everything has to move the story forward. No detail can ever be there just for its own sake. It just has to piggyback with what's really happening in the scene. So I kind of set a rule for myself that the two image rule, I really can't afford more than two images in a paragraph. Especially because I work to make them really good, like the breath of the terrarium condensed on the shoulders of on the glass shoulders of the jar. I want to make them like poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make them really good. But if you have too many of them, then you're showing off. If I write something and then I, on rereading, I feel that this is going to stop the reader, even if it's to stop and say, "Wow, Barbara Kingsolver is a really good writer." That's showing off. That needs to come out,
right.
Because I don't want you to be reading about me writing. I want you to forget all about me and just be in the story. It's kind of like I use the analogy of the ballerina. You're supposed to watch the ballerina and believe and see her defying gravity. You don't want to look at her and think her feet are bleeding, even though, in fact, they are. You know. So that's the goal is to make it look easy.
Yeah. And what I'll add, and my question links on to the last question, so what I would add to what you were just saying is that what makes the detail of that piece that I just read and you were talking about so perfect, too, is that it's what Thatcher chooses to notice in her room, and it's very much mm-hmm. his point of view that's chosen to see that thing, which mm-hmm. is lovely, and tells us what he notices. So another thing that he sees in the world, I love this, he tends to categorize people botanically.
Mm-hmm. Because he's a botanist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So his last name is Greenwood, and he sees himself as a sapling. His wife is named Rose, and he sees her as a rose. Her sister Polly, he says, is a hollyhock, cheerful, forthright, tallest bloom in the garden. And then my favorite was, he saw the corseted bulwark of his mother-in-law laboring at her writing desk, the shoulders grandiosely hunched in the mutton-chopped sleeves of a florid dress. Aurelia was a Cattleya orchid, immoderately showy, epiphytic by nature, rising above the common dirt.
Yes, and I realized when I wrote that I was kind of insulting orchids, but
and I was so worried about saying Cattleya right that I missaid orchid, but anyway,
Cattleya orchid, yeah, but they are. Let's face it, they are showy.
Yeah, so I loved that. But I loved that he sees the world that way, and he saw those little green worlds inside the glass jars. And so I wondered if you have advice for depicting characters in a way that they grow on the page as individuals and make sense to us. It's kind of a big question, but on the heels of that other question, I'm wondering if that brings to mind any advice you might have.
Well, I think my answer to that, would be most any fiction writer's answer to that, which is make sure that these characters are not you. Put yourself away and think about what it is to be the someone else that you're writing about, and cultivate empathy for more than empathy. Cultivate identity with every character in your story, even the ones that if you met them, you probably wouldn't like. But for the purpose of, like, such as Nick, who is this
curmudgeon.
he's worse than a curmudgeon. Right. He's racist, sexist. They talk about this foul effluent of profanity that's just kind of always rolling off of him. He's this old, sick, grumpy guy whose politics are very different from everybody in the household. And he took a lot of work, but I had to love Nick and get inside of him to write him reliably, because if I had written about him from the outside as a person I don't like, he wouldn't seem authentic, because everybody likes themselves. Well, I mean, even the people who don't like themselves still think they're right, no matter how annoying they may be or how, you know, ill-advised the things they do may seem to other people. It's right to them. Even Hitler thought he was a great guy. You know, he thought, he believed he was saving the world. So every character in your story has to be understood from the inside. You have to know how it feels to do that stuff and believe it's the right thing to do.
Right.
That's a profound exercise in empathy, but it starts with you, because what you're building for the reader is empathy for these characters. So as a follow-up to that, I mean, I'm reluctant to give advice, because I don't know how, you know, you should do this, anybody else should do this. I only know what works for me. But one thing that really did work out for me is in school, in college and graduate school, I studied science. My degrees are in biology. I didn't study writing. Well, I learned to write by reading. I studied
Middlemarch.
Middlemarch, for example. And Dickens for plot and Wolfe for voice, and, you know, just by reading books that I wish I could have written for years and years and years and years. And reading thoughtfully and critically, I taught myself to write. But in school, when I had the opportunity to study invertebrate biology or botany, I taught botany, for example, for a while as a graduate student. I was a TA and taught ecology, botany, all kinds of things. So having confidence in other disciplines really helps me as a writer, because, I mean, all your characters can't be writers. And if that's all you know, you have a pretty limited arsenal.
Right.
So I feel really lucky that I have the option of creating these characters who are scientists, I've written characters who were entomologists, wildlife, I mean, not in this novel, but just all together. I've created characters who had a lot of different professions, and many of them have been scientists, and that's something that I have access to, because if it's not a discipline I know well, I'm not intimidated by the literature. I can get to know it really well. So that would be my advice, is study broadly. Try to learn other things besides writing when you get the opportunity, because it all helps. You have to be the smartest person in your novel. You can't just say, then he said something very interesting about botany. You know, you have to know what it was.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, I want to just mention again that the title of the novel is Unsheltered. It is by Barbara Kingsolver, published by Harper. And thank you so much. I've really enjoyed speaking with you today.
I have too. This was great. Thanks for what you do.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Barbara Kingsolver. You can learn more about her work at kingsolver.com. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.